Chapter 5 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 5. I hope that no reader of what I have just written will imagine that I am defending vice. I am not defending it. I hate and loathe it, and I venture to say that I have more right to stand up in the face of the world and say so than most men. I bitterly resent that I was robbed of my virtue and my innocence in my helpless boyhood by being put into a community which one of its own distinguished sons compared to hell. If I had escaped untarnished from Winchester and Oxford, it would have been a miracle, and I would have been a saint. On the other hand, if I had been born a Catholic, or had become one in early childhood, it is 1,000 to 1 that I would have passed unscathed through the same period. That is what I mean when I say that I bitterly resent what happened. The real truth is, of course, that the sort of things boys do at school and college, and that Oscar Wilde and thousands of others go on doing all their lives, are contrary to Christian ethics, but not to pagan ethics. I do not mean that even in classic Greece they were not condemned by the very highest minds, but they were, at the worst, regarded as venial offences, and did not provoke any of that horror and consternation which they are supposed to provoke in this country. But if England is practically today a pagan country, and statistics as to the number of churchgoers prove that she is, what right has she to pose as aghast at pagan habits? None whatever. When she has returned to the faith of her fathers, on which, for commercial and other ignoble reasons, she turned her back at the so-called Reformation, it will be time enough for her to endeavour to get back into the true Catholic attitude towards sin, which she has repudiated and denied. As things are at present, the attitude of the average Englishman on this point is not only hypocritical, but absurd. If he really feels such horror at the practices in question, why does he pitchfork his children at the tender age of 12 to 14 into the very places where they are practically certain to learn them? Why are boys brought up to read the classic authors, including the Eclogues of Virgil, not accepting, as Byron says, that Horridon beginning with the Formosum Pastor Corridon? Why were we at Oxford taught to read Plato and to regard the Symposium as a magnificent work? I am quite aware, of course, that in the Symposium Socrates is on the side of purity, but there is nothing of the unmentionable attitude in the dialogue towards what the Englishman pretends to regard with such horror. One is forced to the conclusion that what England really feels about it is summed up in the one word, hypocrisy. Do what you like, it really doesn't matter in the least. We all do it at one time or another of our lives, but we must never admit it. And at all costs, we must keep up the attitude of amazed horror at any open manifestation of it in others that comes before us in our official capacity. Well, to paraphrase Ideal Ward again, is it possible to conceive anything more like hell than such an attitude? When I said at the beginning of this chapter that I had more right than most men to stand up in the face of the world and say that I hate and loathe vice, and particularly this vice, I said something which calls for explanation. Well, here is the explanation. I take it that no one has a right to condemn others for a vice which he practices himself. Anyone will agree to that proposition, I suppose. I will go a great deal further and say that no one who is not entirely chaste has any right to condemn others for any form of impurity. I would not have dared to write this book, and to tell the truth about myself, if I could not say that I have been absolutely chaste, as I have been, for more than 14 years, and that I intend to remain in the same condition up till the day of my death. I ceased to have any part or lot in the Oscar Wilde business at least 26 years ago, when I married. But that in itself would not give me any right to condemn others. Far from it. Later, when, after my wife had left me, just before the trial of the ransom action, I was alone in the world, I had the choice of leading an immoral life, or conforming to the strict Catholic ideal of absolute purity. For about 2 months after my wife left me, about 14 years ago, I lived with a very beautiful girl, who sought me out because she was sorry for me, and thought I had been brutally treated. I had already been a Catholic then for about 18 months, and I knew I was committing and persisting in mortal sin by what I did. My conscience gave me no peace till I finally broke off the affair, and from that day I have lived absolutely chaste, except for 2 lapses in the first year, and have, as I put it in my poem In Excelsis, recaptured my innocence. And if, disvouching then my angel's voice, I could, by natural spirit, so outface the frowning world and its proclaimed offence against my friend, shall I not more rejoice to hate and brave it now, bestead by grace and my long since recaptured innocence? And even this does not give me the right to condemn others. I see that now, though at one time I thought it did. There was a time when I went after Robert Ross, as I was fully justified in doing in self-defence, and to right a great wrong, when I succeeded, I fear, in kidding myself into believing that I was carrying on a sort of purity crusade. The attitude is reflected in some of my satires, and in the book Oscar Wilde and Myself, which I wrote with Crossland. I wish to repudiate that attitude here and now. It is not for me to condemn or judge anyone else, but I do repeat that I have now a better right than most men to say that I hate and loathe every form of sexual vice, because it is the literal truth that I would far rather die any day than indulge in any such vice. And though I do not doubt that there are plenty of virtuous and unmarried men in this country who could say the same, there is, for example, the whole body of the Catholic priesthood, I feel perfectly certain that they are in a very small minority. It is, I hope, scarcely necessary for me to say that I am not going into all these intimate details about my private life with any idea of holding myself up to admiration as a reformed rake. The fact is that I am forced to do it because of the lies that have been told about me, and because it would be impossible for me to tell what I have set out to tell, at whatever cost to my own feelings, without explaining exactly how I stand. If I refer, as I have done, and am going to do again, to affairs with women, it is most emphatically not from the complacent point of view adopted by gentlemen like Mr. George Moore and Mr. Frank Harris. I am so far from being proud of such adventures that I am ashamed of them, and it gives me great pain to have to mention them. But I am trying to show that I was simply just like other young men of my class and education, and not any kind of monster remotely resembling what some of my enemies have tried to make me out. From a Catholic point of view, of course, I was very wicked. I am quite ready to admit that, provided it is accepted that 90% of my contemporaries were exactly the same. I will cheerfully submit to be condemned, and afterwards freely pardoned, as I have been years ago, by the Church of Christ, but I utterly decline to do penance before, shall we say, Mr. Justice Darling, or any of the numerous deadly cross-examiners who have cross-examined me at various times on the instructions of the late Sir George Lewis. End of chapter 5.